Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back to the show. We don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And I want to start this week by thanking everyone who has called, emailed, left messages, inquiring about my wife's family back in Japan. And I just want to let everyone know that they are fine down in Okinawa. They did have some evacuations, but only some rough surf and nothing major. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all the people devastated by the tragedy in Japan this week. But hopefully we can cobble together an hour of relevant commentary regarding that and other matters that face the entire world. As we delve into the week ahead, we'll look back upon the week that was and outline for you the implications of all that is and all that was on all that is coming our way. Now, I want to start with lighter news. We've all been impacted by the things we've seen this past week. I happened to be driving out to Salt Lake City and arrived at the hotel at about 1 a.m. and turned on the television, not knowing that anything had happened, and began to watch the scene of the tsunami coming in live from NHK television in Japan. And I've got to say that it was, it was biblical and epic in proportion to watch that happen, that black wave as it devoured that little town, that little airport. It was truly shocking. And I couldn't get to sleep until 3 o'clock in the morning watching the live feed. But, the earth is relatively young and relatively unstable. And so we can expect things like this to happen on a young Earth. If the Earth was truly 5 or 15 billion years old, however old it is in this year's curriculum, there are institutes of higher learning and lower living. If the Earth was actually that old, it would be much more stable, I would think. But then again, I'm no scientist. That's just my 2 cents worth on the topic. But let's start... Let's start with a story out of The Guardian over in London, which is probably some liberal rag. I have no idea, but it relates to one of my all-time favorites, Burger King. Now, I've got to tell you, I do a lot of travel by car, driving, and probably the perfect road food is the Burger King Bacon Double Cheeseburger. Two of those and a Coke, and I can pretty much last all day. So mark me down as a fan of Burger King. But here we go to The Guardian. The global boss of the fast food empire Burger King has had to apologize after he told a group of American students that British women were unattractive and that English food was terrible. In unguarded comments, Burger King's chief executive Bernardo Hees offered a none-too-fond account of his younger days studying for an MBA at the University of Warwick. Recalling that there were few distractions to put him off his studies, he said, quote, "The food is terrible, and the women are not very attractive." Ouch. England. Yeah, well, what are you going to say? I mean, America has a special relationship with our cousins across the pond there in England. But, the food is pretty lousy. My wife and I, we went to Israel back in 1999. Has it been that long? It's been that long, 1999. But we basically retraced inversely the steps of tens of thousands of Jews. We went to New York, and then from New York we went to England, and then from England we went to Israel, where we spent a couple of 3 weeks there at the lovely King David Hotel in Jerusalem. If you ever get to go to Jerusalem, I recommend the King David. Yeah, I remember when we got there, and had a chance to see the price of the room. The rooms at the King David are much sought after, and very expensive. And we were there with an older gentleman who wanted to tour Israel, but he just needed some younger folks to be with him in case he fell down or got lost or just needed some help. So he took me and my wife, my extremely attractive audio engineer, who unfortunately today is in the throes of a virus. And it's been a daunting couple of days for her. She's not able to even crawl into the studio as we go to podcast. But she'll be back with us next week. She'll be in rare form, I'm sure. But where was I going? Oh, yes, yes. So after spending 3 weeks in Israel at the... Oh, the price of the room. That's right. The price of the room. When I saw the price of the room, I told my elderly friend, who was kind enough to take us there, I said, Billy, I said, I've never seen a hotel bill with that many digits after the comma. I said, I Takako and I, we could stay at the hotel across the street. This is, don't you think this is a bit much, the King David? And he said, Doug, why don't we just let it ride? And so we spent 3 weeks at the King David Hotel, open up the shutters and on the sash of the window and look out over the old city. And it was fantastic. If you ever have an opportunity to go to Israel, I highly recommend you do just that. But I remember distinctly that Jerusalem is a city where a 19-year-old man cannot get a bacon double cheeseburger, but he can walk into Burger King with an M16. Interesting juxtaposition of facts there. But I do remember that flying back out of Jerusalem after eating Middle Eastern food for 3 weeks, we hit London, and we had a day and a night. And the first thing we did was we went to a Burger King in London before we went down to tour Piccadilly Circus and see Buckingham Palace and all of that. The first thing we did was go get ourselves a bacon double cheeseburger. And we said, thank heavens for Western civilization, and we kissed the ground. And but anyways, how did I get off on talking about all this? You know, without my extremely attractive audio engineer here, I'm a bit out of sorts. Oh, yes, we're talking about Burger King. So this poor Bernardo Hess, billionaire, sitting atop the Burger King empire, The Guardian tells us, Hess's remarks, which were reported by the University of Chicago student newspaper, the Chicago Moron, the Chicago Maroon, his comments have raised hackles both among female students and the British folks who hang around there. Let's see, we have a quote from one Charlie Fitzner, women's campaign officer at Warwick University Student Union. She said, quote, if he views women as potential distractions in academia, I wonder how he views them in the workplace. It doesn't make Burger King an attractive employer for women. Well, quick note to Charlie. It's Burger King. It's not an attractive employer for anyone. If you're working at Burger King and you're beyond your 20s, you've probably made some poor decisions in your life. Anyway. But as far as the women not being very attractive in England, I have no comment on that. I couldn't tell you about that. But the food, well, the Burger King was pretty darn good. But the fare at the local restaurants left a bit to be desired, I must say. All right. Now, let's move on to stories that may or may not be more important. We go to the Wall Street Journal. Always a reliable source for ridiculous political news. And we've got a story about how Congress spends your money. So this shouldn't be a shock at all, but it will probably be somewhat disturbing. Apparently, departing members of the House of Representatives, as they closed down their offices, paid their employees $6.7 million, or more than 30% more in the fourth quarter of 2010, than they did on average in the first three quarters of the year. So on the way out the door, all of the pagan, barbarian scum who had occupied the House of Representatives, as they were being thrown out, they ratcheted up the pay of their staffers, distributing over almost $7 million to them that they normally wouldn't have gotten. Now, the article from the online Wall Street Journal points out that's about the The 31% raise for departing staffers was about twice as much as the 16% increase awarded by the lawmakers who returned to Congress. And the Wall Street Journal says the disparity suggests retiring or defeated members use remaining funds of their official expense budgets to boost salaries for staffers before they left Washington, and that is cash that might otherwise have been returned to the U.S. Treasury. So they stole another $6.7 million. But what really annoys me is that every one of these loser staffers received at least a 16% pay raise. And I suppose that in Washington, a 16% pay raise in a year when the economy remains in the toilet is just dubbed honest graft. But the defeated members giving a 30% raise, well, that goes a bit beyond the pale. I mean, we know how to steal here at the House of Representatives, and you have to be discreet about it. So it's all been exposed. As if anyone's surprised. A 16% raise for the Republican staffers who were elected by the Tea Party. And the Democrats steal 30% and head out the door. And there you have it. That's the state of politics. More from the politics file. The Department of Education, this is according to the Associated Press, the Department of Education estimates the percentage of schools failing to meet yearly targets for their students' proficiency in math and reading could jump from 37 to 82% as states raise standards in attempts to satisfy the No Child Left Behind law's mandates. So the standards are ratcheting up, and that means schools are going to be falling by the wayside. The 2002 No Child Left Behind law from your friend and mine, George W. Bush, liberal. The 2002 No Child Left Behind law requires states to set targets aimed at having all students proficient in math and reading by 2014. So, talk about low standards. You want your students proficient in math and reading by 2014? How about having them proficient in math and reading by the end of the school year? How's that for a high goal? I guess we don't set the bar too high, because the bureaucrats and slackers in the public education system would no doubt, their self-esteem would no doubt be devastated when they learn that they were completely incompetent. We have a quote from Education Secretary Arne Duncan. He says, quote, "No Child Left Behind is broken, and we need to fix it now." He said with a straight face, "This law has created 1,000 ways for schools to fail and very few ways to help them succeed." Oh, Arnie. My heart bleeds for you, brother. Oh, it's got to be tough. What more do we have here from this AP article? Republicans and Democrats agree that the law needs to be reformed because, obviously, there's a lot of patronage jobs within the Department of Education that need to be prepared for the incoming freshmen's nephews and nieces. Oh, don't you worry. Or don't be deceived, you Tea Partiers. The powers that be in Washington are going to teach your freshmen how business is done. And the last thing we can have is the appearance that any aspect of government is failing if we're going to seduce these young freshmen and corrupt them by the end of the congressional session. What else does Arnie have to say here? Arnie says, quote, "We should get out of the business of labeling schools as failures and create a new law that is fair and flexible and focused on the schools and students most at risk." Arnie, you should get out of the business of schools. The government should get out of the business of schools, Arnie. And don't worry, Arnie. I'm sure that your friends in the Democrat Party can find another patronage job for you and your wife and your nephew and your niece and all the slacker morons in your family who couldn't hold a real job in the private sector. They'll find a place to put you, Arnie. In the meantime, if you are sending your children to the public schools, ladies and gentlemen, you're sinning against your child and you're sinning against God, and you need to repent. I had a long email exchange with some conservatives who were upset with me for saying that sending your kids to public school is a sin. And I don't know, I thought it was fairly obvious. I didn't think that the comment was in any way controversial. But apparently they took offense. And they said, well, what about the poor? What about the underprivileged and the minorities? And I wrote back, aren't the poor and the underprivileged and the minorities, aren't they going to stand before God as well? Are they not going to stand before the judge of all the world? And will he not judge rightly? You, I'm your host, Doug McBurney. So good to have you along this week. Hope you're enjoying the broadcast. Today will be a random sampling of music because I have no idea what I'm doing. Yes, my extremely attractive audio engineers upstairs languishing in the throes of the virus, and I bravely soldier on. For you. That's right. Now let's go into the culture file as we delve deeper into the rot that is engulfing us all. Let's go to, this is from France24.com, French news service, the French press agency. The Royal Academy of Engineers in France said the application of GPS is now so broad, from cars to the timestamps on financial transactions, that without adequate backup, any disruption could have a major impact. It cited a recent European Commission study showing that 6 to 7% of economic growth in Western countries, about $1.1 billion, is already dependent on GPS in one way or another. A disruption, they say, could come from technological problems or from deliberate interference by criminals using small-scale jammers to avoid road tolls or block the tracking of cargo, to terrorists seeking to attack the entire system. The report also warns of political interference, such as when North Korea reportedly recently disrupted South Korean military communications. The U.S.-operated global positioning system is currently used for everything from commercial aircraft. Well, that's not supposed to happen. Why is that happening again? Oh, I see. The program that should never be running is running again. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. Let me just a few quick keystrokes, speaking of a reliance on technology, and the problem is repaired. Okay, the U.S.-operated global positioning system is currently used for everything from commercial aircraft and the tracking of cargo to the opening of train doors at train stations. Well, I'll admit right up front that I do a lot of travel on the road. I've become helplessly addicted or helplessly dependent upon my GPS, to the point where generally I don't even know what direction I'm going anymore. And I think all this technology makes us stupid. And I hope that the carpet is not pulled from beneath us, because I'll just be wandering around in circles not knowing where I'm going. I've forgotten how to navigate, although I was never that great at navigation. When I was in the Marine Corps, I was at a small helicopter base outside of Anjong-ri in Korea. And I was told by the captain, he said, McBurney, he said, get the radio truck. He says, drive up to Korea, Seoul, to the airport. There is a convoy that's waiting, and it's your job to guide the convoy down here to Anjong-ri, onto the base. I said, no problem, captain. I'm on my way, sir. I made it to the airport okay. And I did my best to keep track of the directions, but the road signs in Korea leave a little bit to be desired. So we got up to the head of the convoy, about 20 trucks, and we started heading back from the airport down to Anjong-ri, and this was 1987. So they were building the Olympic Village there in Seoul, And somehow, for the first hour and a half, we ended up in the construction zone of the Olympic Village, driving around in circles until finally some nice Korean police officers were friendly enough and kind enough to guide us out onto the main highway leading to Anjanri. And 4 or 5 hours later, I had to radio back to the base and say, could you send someone to get us? Because I don't know where we are. And this is frankly getting pretty embarrassing for me as a Marine. Well, I never heard the end of that. I can tell you that. So anyway, I was never that good at navigation to begin with, despite the best efforts of the United States Marine Corps. And now that I'm on the GPS, I'm completely worthless. It's just sad. All right. Now, let's move into the politics file. From Washington, D.C., the Associated Press, President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, also known as Barry Ho and his M.O., headlined a conference last Thursday on preventing bullying. In a Facebook video promoting the conference, Obama says bullying is not an unavoidable part of growing up. And what does his M.O. have to say? As a mother of two, M.O. says it's everyone's responsibility to make sure that kids treat each other with respect. And it's just such a lovey-dovey, mushy-gushy feel-good. They had an all-day affair over bullying at the White House while Muammar Gaddafi is bombing the rebels and the Middle East is generally erupting into chaos. He's focused on bullying. Anyway, it's interesting. M.O. says that it's everyone's responsibility to make sure kids treat each other with respect. How about this, Michelle? How about my kids will be my responsibility and your kids be your responsibility, and maybe we could just get along. Maybe we could get along on the basis of that. A little bit of mutual respect. Michelle, I'd rather you not be responsible for making sure my kids treat other kids in any fashion. I'll take care of that, Michelle. You take care of yours. And if you're out there in the audience, take care of your own kids. Don't let the government take care of your kids. They don't do a good job of it. Although I'm sure Barry Ho and his M.O. do a fine job with their two lovely young daughters. They can just keep their opinions to themselves, and I'll keep my kids to myself. Thank you very much. I'm not a big fan of everyone's responsible. That's not the way I roll. You know what I'm saying, Michelle? All right. Now, here is a terrifying, disturbing, and disgusting story from the politics file. This is from Politico. According to a Rutgers Eagleton poll released last week, Mitt Romney has edged out a one-point lead over New Jersey governor. What's the New Jersey governor's name? Chris Christie. So they had a poll in New Jersey amongst Republicans. I'm sorry, amongst just your average know-nothing, ignorant, vacuous voter there in New Jersey. And most New Jersey voters, 48%, said Barack Obama deserves re-election. And 12% said Mitt Romney. 11% said Chris Christie. Now, here's the problem I have with you Republicans. And I say that as a registered Republican. And I'm only registered as a Republican for silly, stupid reasons. I never thought I would ever re-register as a Republican. But in the run-up to the personhood vote here in Colorado, we found that it was to our best tactical interest to all register as Republicans and even participate in Republican events, because Republicans are generally a little less combative toward personhood than our Democrats. And for those of you who are uninitiated in the audience, personhood is a movement to recodify the personhood of every human being from the moment that they pop into existence, the moment of fertilization, conception, the beginning of biological development. It's the greatest human rights movement in yours or my lifetime. And if you're not involved, you're missing the boat. Yes. So get involved. Go to Personhood USA, click through, find out what's going on, find out what you can do to try to save the world from the barbarians who would kill even their own children, and yours too. All right. Now, back to the story. Mitt Romney beats Chris Christie. This is the problem I have with you Republicans. And this is why I'm just wearing a thin veneer of Republicanism, and I'm not a hardcore dyed-in-the-wool Republican, is because you Republicans are out of your minds. How could you possibly, even in a state like New Jersey, How could you possibly think that Mitt Romney is qualified to be president of the United States? He's a two-faced, low-life liar. He's a baby killer. He's a homo lover. He's a money stealer. He's a government health care, big government liar. And yet the Republicans continue to march behind him like he's the Pied Piper. And I think he's going to make some kind of run at the presidency. It should be fun to watch. I'm hoping that Mitt Romney has disillusioned enough genuine conservatives to never have a chance, ever, to become the president. But this poll makes me a little nervous and makes me... It makes my concerns about the Republican Party that much more prescient, at least in my mind. Mitt Romney. He does have great hair, and he is pretty tall. So with like 80% of Americans, that's all it takes. I shouldn't say 80, about 70%. But there's 30% of us who are still sane. There are 30% of us who are actually aware, and we could possibly save the country if we can be properly motivated. And that's my goal here at the Weekly Worldview, to properly motivate you as a sane American to try to preserve your country from the barbarians at the gates. Mitt Romney being at the head of that pack, pounding against the gates with his perfect hair and his $50 copay abortions, his Romney Care government health care bill, and his sodomy marriages that he instituted as a Republican. In the formerly barely tolerable state of, where was he? Massachusetts. Formerly barely tolerable. Now I can't even go near the place. All right. Let's go on. Okay, more from the Republican Party. Just in case, now if you're upset with me because I've been less than generous with the Republicans, well, perhaps this will help you understand my position. Newt Gingrich gave an interview this week where he was asked about his indiscretions with his first two wives. And he said, quote, "There's no question at times of my life, partially driven by how passionately I felt about this country, that I worked far too hard and things happened in my life that were not appropriate." Well, that's a pretty politically astute way to put it, Newt. See, Newt cheated on his first wife when she was dying of cancer. And then he cheated on his second wife with a staffer who's now his third wife, and he says this is the one. But I like this. He says partially driven. So his adulterous affairs were partially driven by how passionately he felt about this country. That's another way of saying they were mostly driven by his inability to control his appetite. Mostly, that's why they were driven. But partially because of how passionately he feels about the country. And then he says, he worked too hard and things happened in my life. You know, I was working real hard late at the office that night when that staffer just dropped down out of the ceiling tiles into my lap. Things happened. It was because I was working so hard. If I hadn't have been there that late, she might not have fallen on me. And you know. Anyway, Gingrich went on to say that he and his third wife, Callista, have a great marriage. Just great. I'm sure it's fabulous. Let's see. The former U.S. House Speaker, this is according to the Associated Press, once again. The former U.S. House Speaker has said he had an affair with Callista while married to his second wife. She was the one who fell out of the ceiling tiles, apparently. This was in an interview with a Christian broadcaster. Oh, I see. Now this all starts to make sense. So this is a Christian broadcaster. Did the interview. And the article says that the interview comes as Gingrich gears up for a likely presidential run. And you know what the first order of business of a phony baloney Republican like Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney is. The first order of business in seeking the presidency is to bamboozle the gullible Christians. It is the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, trying to man the mixing board and also trying to think and be entertaining and the informative and all of that. And it's going all right. But maybe I better stop listening to music. Anyway, that wasn't a bad bump for going blind here. I don't even know what I'm doing. Managed to hit that one all right. Okay, we're back, folks. We're back. We're halfway through the show, and had to run quickly and check on my extremely attractive audio engineer. And well, she's not doing well. She's not doing well, but she's going to be all right. Okay. Now let's move on. Let's go into the culture file. This is a story from the New York Post, and it's about single moms. Very popular subject these days. The New York Post says, from Los Angeles to Harlem, to the Upper East Side, the population went spastic last week when presidential wannabe Mike Huckabee uttered a ticklish truth about the rich preggers and proudly unmarried Oscar winner Natalie Portman, who I'm still not really generally aware of her career, but apparently she's allegedly someone, and we covered Mike Huckabee's remarks last week. Well, we've got commentary on that from one Whoopi Goldberg, who is just sexually vague. I'm not sure what the deal is with Whoopi. I don't know if she'd actually be able to procreate or which side of the deal she'd be on. But so I don't know why she's even commenting on this subject, but I think it's because she likes to interject herself into meaningful conversations that are going on in the culture so that she can appear to be relevant, at least in her own very small mind. But Whoopi said, get off the backs of women, Mike. These women are trying to raise their kids. Get off their damn backs. I'm sick of this. unquote. That's Whoopi Goldberg. Not a very good impression of Whoopi, but honestly, I haven't studied her that much. But so Whoopi's upset, as you can well imagine. She said that on a show called The View. Anyway, is there anything else? Oh, the New York Post tells us, throughout America, millions of children are doomed. Generations go from cradle to the dole as the unwed birth rate reaches a dizzying height. One child in four born in this country is now illegitimate. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. Hollywood need not worry. In the 19 years since Vice President Dan Quayle sparked scorn and debate by criticizing Murphy Brown, much has changed. And for that, you can thank today's A-list role models and spiritual guides who insist to the younger generation that you evolved from slime, you can have sex with anyone you want, there are no real consequences, and you need to follow your heart's desire, and you need to do what's right in your own eyes, which is a lie. Don't need to do what's right in your own eyes. You need to find a quality standard outside of yourself, and you need to follow that standard. And Jesus is the standard. And if you follow that standard, you will build your house upon the rock. If you do what's right in your own eyes, you'll build your house upon the sand, and you will be swept away when the earthquakes come and the rains and the floods. All right. Certainly not going to build our house anywhere near Whoopi Goldberg's house. And if we do build our house on the rock, we're going to make sure that if we subscribe to cable that we cut off The View. I'm going to block that out. And MTV. And HBO. And Cinemax. And Showtime. And is there anyone I've missed? Most of what's on ESPN. Well, the commercials anyway. They're downright borderline pornography anymore. Anyway. Let's see. Okay, now I've had my fun with the Republicans and Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, Newt Gingrich and Whoopi Goldberg are almost on the same, to me, they're on the same general plateau of ignorance. I used to be a Newt Gingrich fan, even bought his book back when I was just an empty head. Anyway, embarrassed about that. Do we still have that on the bookshelf? Nope, we got rid of it. Okay, yeah, because I told my extremely attractive audio engineer when she was redesigning my office here in the basement studios that certain books had to be gotten rid of. And the first one into the bucket was To Renew America by Newt Gingrich, which I stood in line to get him to sign. How embarrassing is that? How could I have let that out? I'll never live that down. All right, now, so let's move on now to the Christians. Here's the problem I have with you Christians, okay? For a story from WorldNet Daily, Dateline Washington, Tim LaHaye, the best-selling author of Left Behind, the Left Behind series of Bible prophecy novels, who was in Maui when the tsunami and earthquake struck in Japan, said that being caught in the crossfire of the fourth largest earthquake in modern history helped prepare him for two prophecy conferences he was scheduled to address in Hawaii. He said, quote, "The Bible tells us in Matthew 24 that one of the signs of the last days, one of the birth pangs to occur, is an increase in earthquake activity and intensity." LaHaye said, "We're seeing that happen now. It's not just earthquakes, but hurricanes and all kinds of natural disasters." Tim LaHaye, it's the end of days. And this is the problem I have with you Christians, you superstitious Christians, who every time there's a natural disaster or a financial collapse, you just automatically start assuming it's the last days or the end times. And it's just embarrassing, folks. I mean, there have been catastrophic events throughout history that had nothing to do with the birth pangs leading to the return of Jesus Christ and his setting up of his kingdom on earth. I mean, can you imagine if you lived in eastern Poland during World War II and your town was taken by the Germans and then the Reds and then the Germans and then the Reds? Surely you would have thought it's the end of days. Surely things couldn't get any worse. But it wasn't. And this isn't either. It's just a really bad earthquake. And anyway, while it's nice to sell books on end times hysteria, and Mr. LaHaye, I'm sure he writes some fine books. But we all need to be prepared for the end times because, I mean, the end times for me is definitely going to be within 30 or 40 years, maybe 50 if I'm lucky, right? My end times are coming. So are yours. So you need to be prepared on a personal level. And it's interesting to talk about, debate, and write about the big picture. But get prepared on a personal level. Find out who is the creator. Find out if Jesus Christ is worthy of your attention. Find out if what he said rings true to you. Find out who he is. And make your decision now. Because your end times is coming. Our coming is coming. Your end time is coming. Anyway, you know what I mean. Okay, now, let's move on into the war file from Quincy, Oklahoma. Oklahoma? How does Oklahoma make it into the war file, you might ask? Well, the author of a book on the Oklahoma City bombing says a homeless man arrested in Quincy last Wednesday is the same man identified by several witnesses to the bombing as having been with Timothy McVeigh before the deadly attack on the Murrah Building in 1995. But an FBI spokesman said a man named Hussein al-Husseini was thoroughly investigated and found not to have any role whatsoever in the attack on the aforementioned Murrah Building back in 1995. This spokesmouth for the FBI did confirm that a man named Hussein al-Husseini had been seen with McVeigh prior to the bombing. So Quincy police last Thursday spoke with the author of the book, The Third Bomber, and notified the FBI of the arrest of al-Husseini. He apparently has slashed another man's face with a beer bottle, and he's a homeless loser living in Quincy, Oklahoma. The author of the Oklahoma City bombing book, The Third Terrorist, The Middle East Connection to the Oklahoma City Bombing, she says that the man arrested in Quincy also has a tattoo on his arm that matches the description of one on the arm of the man in the book. What's the author of the book? What's her name? Well, that's embarrassing not to be prepared here and have that ready for you. Anyway, it's a good book. I read it, and that's why this story caught my... Jaina Davis, J-A-Y-N-A, Jaina Davis is the author. And she says that this homeless guy who was arrested last week in Oklahoma, she says his age, his name, the picture, the mugshot, she says that's him. That's the guy that she was made fun of for saying had been hanging out with McVeigh, even though the FBI acknowledged that he had been hanging out with McVeigh. But he was just a disaffected Iraqi soldier. There's no way he could have had anything to do with bombing a building in the United States not too long after the Iraq War. No, couldn't have had anything. Middle Eastern men don't blow up buildings, generally. It's typically deranged white meth addicts, like Timothy McVeigh. Surely Hussein Husseini couldn't have had anything to do with it. What was his name again? Hussein Husseini? Oh, no way, no. Anyway, Davis says, the author, Jaina Davis, says the al-Husseini she wrote about is a former Iraqi soldier who was seen with McVeigh in the weeks before the bombing. And on April 19th, 1995, the day of the bombing, which killed 168 people, now he's sitting in jail in Oklahoma, and we'll see if the federal authorities are able to link Hussein Husseini to the Oklahoma City bombing. Even if he confessed to it, they would probably insist that he couldn't have had anything to do with it, because, I mean, that commentary has already been written. It was a deranged white guy. We all know that. All right. Let's see. More from the war file from Hagerstown, Maryland. The Marine Corps says it has issued a suicide-proof sleeping garment to the imprisoned Army private and open homosexual suspected of giving classified material to WikiLeaks. Base Commander Colonel Thomas Johnson said last week that PFC Bradley open homosexual Manning was given the suicide-proof smock last week as a substitute for clothing that is removed each night from Manning's cell at the brig there in Quantico. Now that's a terrible job to have as a U.S. Marine. You've got to go get the homo's smock. Oh, man. I mean, you know you did something wrong when you end up with that assignment. Okay, that's worse than working in the pot shack. That's worse than guard duty. You have to go pick up the homo's smock every night and make sure he hasn't hung himself with it. Let's see. On March 1st, the base commander denied Manning's request for an easing of the maximum custody order that keeps him locked up alone for 23 hours a day. And the base commander said no, and in fact, we're going to take away your belt, your shoelaces, and for that matter, your clothes, so that you can't kill yourself, so that we can drag out this embarrassment that should have been your trial and execution. We're going to drag this out for years, Bradley. Anyway, well, you know my opinion on homosexuals serving in the military or even living in civil society. You know, in my humble estimation, homosexuality is a criminal offense. Yes, a criminal offense. Maybe not quite as bad as adultery, which I also condemn as a criminal offense, but equally as corrosive to society, perhaps more so. And we certainly shouldn't be talking about allowing them to serve in our military or adopt children or babysit children or teach fourth grade. We should be talking about what punishment do we want to mete out for the crime of homosexuality so that we can discourage the behavior. Because, folks, if everybody goes homo, there's your end times right there. All right. Private Manning. Unbelievable. All right. Let's see now. Oh, we've got an update on a story we did last week regarding your health. A study released last week indicated that people in the United States are losing sleep over their gadgets. All but 5% of people surveyed as a part of the National Sleep Foundation poll said they played video games, watched television, or used smartphones or laptops in the hour before going to bed. Said one Dr. Charles Sisler, from Harvard, quote, "The study reveals that light-emitting screens are in heavy use within the pivotal hour before sleep." Yeah, and apparently being bathed in the glow of monitors or handset screens suppresses the release of the sleep-promoting hormone melatonin and enhances alertness, making it more difficult to sleep. 43% of people aged 13 to 64, according to this poll, felt they rarely or never got a decent night's sleep. During the work week, the sleep-deprived are using caffeine and naps to cope with fatigue. All right, so anyway, my wife and I agreed many, many years ago that we would not have a television set in our bedroom. And not really just because of this, but just, you know, just to try to have a normal human relationship and have some time in the day when we can actually speak with one another. And it's worked out pretty well for us, and I sleep pretty well, I suppose. But anyway, I would highly recommend if you have more than one TV in your house, get rid of them and just have one TV. And that just helps you limit your You know, because TV's like heroin, you know. I mean, you get started on it. Makes you want to throw up at first, but then after that, you just can't live without it. Anyway, that's just my my advice to you, is go with the one TV. And not in the bedroom. Okay. All right. More from the War File. Can we take any more? Is the show over yet? It's not over yet. We got to keep going. All right. More from the War File. James Clapper is in the news again. James Clapper told the U.S. Senate that Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's superior military force would likely prevail over the long term. He said this as Muammar was bombing Libyan rebels and they were fleeing the essential port city of Ras Lanuf. Gaddafi chased him out of there, and James Clapper, being a brilliant observer of the obvious, said it's likely Gaddafi's going to win because all those guns and bombs and bullets and all that he has, he's going to unleash those on these hapless civilians that he's oppressed for all these years. And I can guarantee you one thing, folks, being an amateur student of military history, rarely in the history of warfare have so many bullets been fired and so few people been struck than when you have two opposing Libyan armies. You have the Libyan rebels against the Libyan army. They expend 10,000 bullets. 14 people were injured. Most of those were injured running away. Anyway, Libyan military is not exactly the paragon of military efficiency, in case you didn't get that. Not to put too fine a point on it, but Mr. Clapper, a competent government official able to comment rationally on the obvious. We appreciate that. What does Hillary Clinton have to say? Hillary Clinton has said, this is from a story from the BBC, by the way. Hillary Clinton has said the U.S. would meet representatives of Libyan opposition, but emphasized the U.S. would not undertake military action unilaterally. Hillary said, quote, "We're looking to see whether there's any willingness in the international community to provide any authorization for further steps. Absent international authorization, the U.S. acting alone would be stepping into a situation whose consequences are unforeseeable," unquote. That's Hillary. So here we stand, folks. We're stretched out in two wars in the Middle East. We have natural disasters occurring, and we can't do anything about this bully in the Middle East. I mean, if Barry Ho and his MO are so worried about bullying, you'd think they'd want to make an example of Mr. Gaddafi, but they're unable. They're unable to do so because, and I'm not one to blame things on George W. Bush, but I'm going to blame George W. Bush for having our military stretched out across 5,000 miles of the Middle East instead of going in, breaking it, killing the bad guys, and then allowing it to dissolve and reconstitute in whatever fashion those barbarians in the Middle East, however they want to rule themselves, that's fine. Just don't blow us up, okay? Anyway, we should have been out of there in a couple of years, but instead we're nation building and doing all that friendly stuff. And so now when our opportunity arises to remove a dictator, we find ourselves hamstrung and unable to do it. Thanks, George. Thanks, Barry. Thanks, George Bush the First. Thanks, Bubba Bill, Jeff Clinton. Thank all of you for not realizing that the military is not a political experimentation lab. And long wars are deadly and draining upon a civilization. And I would like nothing more than to see us go in and knock Gaddafi out. But at this point, I would have to say that it's probably not prudent. In the words of George Bush Sr. All right. More from the War File? Is the show over yet? It's not over yet. All right. Let's see. Oh, here we go. Washington, D.C. from the Associated Press. Pledging a relentless drive to kick Muammar Gaddafi out of power, President Barack Obama said Friday that the U.S. and the world community are slowly tightening the noose on the leader of Libya and will keep up the pressure, but he would not commit to intervening at any cost, warning of potential perils in military action. Obama tried to repair the clapper crack in the administration's public stance on Libya because, of course, Barack knows that the uprising in Libya is, of course, going to result in a revolution of democracy, peace, love, and tolerance. And when Mr. Clapper said, well, Gaddafi will probably win because he has more guns. Well, Barry said, Mr. Clapper wasn't talking about policy. So let me be clear again about what our policy, as determined by me, the President of the United States, is. I believe that Gaddafi's on the wrong side of history. I believe the Libyan people are anxious for freedom and the removal of somebody who has suppressed them for decades now. And we are going to be in contact with the opposition, as well as in consultation with the international community, to try to achieve the goal of Mr. Gaddafi being removed from power. Unquote. That was Barry Ho. The NATO alliance continues to review military options in Libya. Planning continues for the possible imposition of what might be considered possibly maybe a no-fly zone over Libya. And by the time they finished pondering and looking and studying and the dust had cleared, the Libyan opposition turned out had been defeated. View. We're rounding third and heading for home. Thanks, Bob. Put those toys away. It's time to get back to the show. From Cairo, from the Jerusalem Post, interesting development in Egypt. Egyptian authorities have released Aboud al-Zamour and Tarek al-Zamour, who were accused in the assassination of Anwar Sadat. That's according to Al Jazeera. The former Egyptian president, Sadat, was shot during a military parade by Khalid el-Islambouli, a member of an Islamist group after Sadat, you'll remember, became the first Arab leader to sign a peace treaty with Israel back in 1979. So Tariq and Aboud al-Zamour had been imprisoned for participating in the assassination plot, and now that tolerance, love, and democracy has spread across Egypt, they're releasing the terrorists from prison. Well, there's only one question that they ask. If you're an Islamist and you're in prison, the new Egyptian government comes and says, do you still hate the Jews? And if the answer is yes, then will you be released then? We're going to need your help. Just wonderful. I hope the folks in Israel are bucking up and getting ready. Because, they got you surrounded. So, like that. All right, let's go to Sheboygan. From the war file. Sheboygan? How could Sheboygan be in the war file? Sheboygan, Wisconsin. State Senator Joe Liebman, not to be confused with corrupt and decrepit Senator Joe Lieberman. This is State Senator Joe Liebman and Glenn Grothman have said they're among as many as 18 Republican senators who've received death threats following their vote to eliminate collective bargaining for public workers. The threat was sent in an email last Wednesday. The letter tells lawmakers to, quote, make your peace with God as soon as possible and say goodbye to your loved ones. Due to your actions in the last 8 weeks, you will be killed. This is a Sheboygan. This isn't Tahrir Square. This isn't Tripoli. This is Sheboygan, for crying out loud. The threatening email went on to say, quote, we feel that you and the people that support the dictator, that's the governor there, we feel that you all have to die. If you and your goonies feel that it's necessary to strip the rights of 300,000 people and ruin their lives, making them unable to feed and clothe and provide the necessities for their families and themselves, then we will get rid of you, by which I mean kill you, unquote. That's the email that was sent from the progressive side of the argument there in Sheboygan, Libya, Wisconsin. All right, let's go to the justice file. From Springfield, Illinois, this is from the Associated Press. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn signed legislation getting rid of the death penalty last Wednesday. So there is no more death penalty in Illinois. It joins some other, how many more states? Most nations, including virtually all of Europe, have abandoned the death penalty. And 16 states here in America have now abolished the death penalty. I've got a quote here from a Chicago woman. A Chicago woman whose teenage son was gunned down in 2006 said the killer, who has never been caught, should not be allowed to breathe the same air she breathes. Amen, sister. Preach it. She said, I'm a Christian. I never believed in killing nobody else. But after my son was shot, the pain you suffer every single day, I say, take them out. Unquote. Preach it, my sister. All right. So, not really a surprise that Quinn has decided to do this up in Illinois. I think they haven't executed anyone there since Governor George Ryan halted executions back in 2000 because he was afraid of killing an innocent man. He's afraid of killing an innocent man. While in his very state, he presided over the killing of tens of thousands of innocent men and women who happened to be in their mother's womb, but they were still people. They're still people. He presided over them, but he was too afraid to execute. Well, what do we have a quote here? We have a quote from Quinn. He said, quote, this is a new governor. George Ryan was afraid of killing innocent people, and he's obviously infected the now governor, Pat Quinn. Quinn says, quote, if the system can't be guaranteed 100% error-free, then we shouldn't have a system. It cannot stand, unquote. Really. Well, Mr. Quinn, that's what God's for. Okay, well, I mean, just that's one thing among many that God's for. God is for sorting out the errors. Now, none of us are perfect, Mr. Quinn. You, least than any of us, less than any of us. But that's what God's for. See, his system minimizes error by minimizing crime. You strike fear into the hearts of the relatively dull-minded people who are pondering a life of crime. You strike fear and terror into their heart, make them afraid to commit crimes, and you won't have a lot of crimes, and then you won't have a lot of errors in your judicial system. Because a crime and a trial would be a major event. God's system minimizes error by minimizing crime, but our system, your system, Mr. Quinn, the system constructed by the progressive liberals in our country over the past number of decades, our system multiplies crime. And it ensures job security for those involved in the justice industry. And abolishing the death penalty, Mr. Quinn, it simply redirects and multiplies the death penalty upon the innocent. Oh, but we've already established that you're okay with killing the innocent, Mr. Quinn. You're only worried about punishing the guilty. All right. I don't care about that story. I'm running out of time. Okay, from the Domestic Tranquility File from Elko, Nevada. Cody Patton was arraigned in Elko District Court last Wednesday on a charge of open murder with the use of a deadly weapon in the beating death of 16-year-old Michaela Costanzo. At first, Patton denied any knowledge of what happened to her. But deputies said he changed his story after police told him he'd been seen on school surveillance video. Patton then described how they argued before he pushed her down, and she first hit her head on the bumper of a Chevy Trailblazer. After more arguing, he said he pushed her again, and she hit her head on a rock. He then told detectives that she suffered some kind of seizure, and he became panicked and swung a shovel at her head, striking her and cutting her neck with the sharp edge of the shovel, at which point a deputy rolled his eyes, pulled out his revolver, and shot Patton in the head. No, that didn't happen. That might have happened had I been in the room. Patton then acknowledged that he had buried this young woman and concealed her body, but insists it was all a misunderstanding and a series of slip-and-fall accidents. So how long should this trial take, folks? I mean, you got an open confession. He shows you where the body's buried. I mean, come on. I'm all for having a trial, but I would just like to see this carried out in a fashion that's worthy of the heinous nature of this crime. This man should be executed with the utmost prejudice as much as possible. All right, more from the Domestic Tranquility File. Laura Lynn Hickey, was arrested last Wednesday after a week-long investigation, which included a post-mortem examination of her baby by a forensic pathologist. The pathologist concluded the 21-week-old baby was alive at birth, but suffered fatal injury by decapitation. Police said the body was found March 2nd under the kitchen sink at Hickey's trailer home. An official said he can't say whether the baby would have survived, but he was alive at the time of his birth. The woman has three other children, and it's just, I don't even know what to say. I just don't even know what to say. All right, and now back one more from the war file as we run out of time here, folks. There was a murder in Israel this past week. A family of five were butchered in their home. A mom, a dad, three of the young children. Three of their young children were all literally butchered in their home. Well, according to Ynet News out of Jerusalem, Gaza residents from the southern city of Rafah hit the streets Saturday to celebrate a terror attack in the West Bank settlement of Itamar, where five family members were murdered in their sleep. Residents handed out candy and sweets. One resident said joy, quote, is a natural response to the harm the settlers inflict on Palestinian residents of the West Bank, unquote. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad said he clearly and firmly denounces the terrorist attack, just as I have denounced crimes against Palestinians. We are all against all types of violence. Our position has not changed. As we have said many times before, we categorically oppose violence and terror, regardless of the identity of the victims or the perpetrators. Well, Mr. Fayyad, that is not categorically opposing anything. That's a rather broad denunciation of some nebulous idea about violence. To categorically oppose violence would be to specifically cite this incident and condemn it, Mr. Fayyad. But apparently Mr. Fayyad realizes that while he may feel the need to condemn violence in general, that the Arab street apparently disagrees with him. And that's why they're celebrating down in Gaza the butchering of a Jewish family in a settlement which you and I know as a house. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the state of things. I mean, that's where we are. And there's the music. Must mean we're coming to the end. And that's appropriate because I have a story about Quentin Tarantino. That would indicate the end of days. Let's see, Quentin Tarantino, director of such horrible films as, well, we won't mention any of them, has filed a lawsuit against his neighbor, Alan Ball, who's another Hollywood type. He's the creator of the True Blood vampire series, which I'm not familiar with. Quentin Tarantino is suing because Mr. Ball has some macaws, an exotic bird. And according to the lawsuit, the birds, it seems... Well, let's see here. The bird belongs to Mr. Ball and his partner, Peter... Oh, great. You know, I'm trying to do a story on a ridiculous lawsuit in Hollywood, and I can't get away from the homos. They're taking over. They're everywhere. I feel like I'm surrounded by queers. So, talk about the Russians against the Germans. Here we've got a lawsuit between Quentin Tarantino and a couple of homos. There's no good guys here. I can't have any fun with this story. It's disgusting. Let's just move on. All right, finally, ladies and gentlemen, from Dayton, Ohio, the Dayton Police Department is lowering its testing standards for recruits. It's a move required by the U.S. Department of Justice after it says not enough African Americans pass the test. So what is their solution? To lower the bar. What was that called a couple of election cycles ago? The soft racism of low expectations? Well, if the brothers can't pass the test, instead of trying to better educate the brothers, we're going to lower the test scores so that we can have morons, white, black, and brown, in uniform. Unbelievable. Under the previous requirements, candidates had to get a 66% on part one and 72 on part two of the exam. So they weren't, like, reaching for the stars already, folks. I mean, where I went to school, a 66 is an F. Anyway... But the Department of Justice approved a new scoring policy that requires potential police officers to get a 58% on Part 1 and a 63% on Part 2, duly insulting to all of our colored brothers and sisters. The Department of Justice has forced other police departments across the country to lower testing standards. This according to ABC. And the Department of Justice cites in those cases that not enough black candidates were passing the substandard test. I can't take anymore. I'm out of here. That's the show for this week, folks. Should the Lord tarry, I'll be back with you next week. I want to thank KGOV.com. I want to thank TheologyOnline.com, Personhood USA, and American Right to Life. Until next week, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.